Beauty does not always signal an empty head. She who confesses that her beauty comes from God will use it for the glory of God. This is what we're going to see today as we look at Esther chapter 3 this morning and then Esther chapter 4 tonight. In the third chapter of this powerful book, we are shown two cultures clashing. That of the Jews and that of the Persians. Even as there is a conflict, a clash between the culture of the world and the culture of the people of Christ. But the book of Esther shows that the one that is in the right will win. In the first six verses of Esther 3, we'll notice now that this clash of the cultures culminates in two men. It starts off by saying this, Esther 3, 1 and 2. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman. For so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Well, Mordecai refused to overexalt Haman, because Mordecai realized that Haman was a man just like himself. They were both men. Whereas the Persians gave God-like honor to their leaders or rulers, Mordecai was a man of conviction, who was willing to go against the crowd, the standard practice of the day, and even the government. And what made that even more phenomenal is the fact that he was actually a captive. Perhaps, I should say that in a sense he was a captive, because at this point the Jews had actually been released. They could have gone back to Judah and Jerusalem if they so desired, but evidently he and Esther desired to stay in the Persian Empire. But he was not a Persian, he was a foreigner. And he has the audacity to do something like this. And of course, that didn't set well with the man who was to receive this honor, as well as the others who were around observing. And so the king's servants seek an opportunity now against this Jew. The record continues. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to him or them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. Mordecai, what are you doing? Why are you excluding yourself? Do you not know that this is the king's command? In other words, you're in serious trouble. This could cost you your life if you're not careful. That's the way the Persians dealt with violators of the law. But he was a man, Mordecai was a man of principle. And men and women of principle will be accused of antisocial behavior, of being fanatics, of belonging to some kind of cult, of being mentally unstable, and all sorts of false accusations. But for the Persians to see a Jew doing this only confirmed their suspicions of a people that they already didn't care for. Evidently, Mordecai had explained that the reason he would not bow or pay homage is because he was a Jew. And from that, I think we can gather the fact that that meant that I am not going to give reverence to a man that only belongs to God. Now, that does not mean that the Jews did not give proper honor to the people to whom it was due. Why, in 1 Kings chapter 1, the Bible tells us that Bathsheba even even bowed to her own son, Solomon, when he was king. But she was doing so simply recognizing his position as king of Israel, not because she thought he was a god. So this was far different than what was going on here. Again, the story continues now in verses 5 and 6. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So Haman saw what was going on. He heard these reports, and it just fills the man and inflames him with anger. But he scorns at the idea of just destroying Mordecai alone. He sees this as an opportunity to get rid of a whole race of people for whom he obviously didn't care very much. In his mind, all the Jews were just like Mordecai, therefore they all deserved to die. Haman seemed to have the idea of either I'm going to rule the Jews or I'm going to ruin them. Rule or ruin. That's my way. In verses 7 through 11, watch now as Haman plots to destroy the Jews. First thing he does is look for a time to do it. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month, until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month Adar. Now notice the time frame that we're being given here. This is the 12th year we're talking about. So this is 4 or 5 years after the events of chapters 1 and 2, after Esther had become queen. So she's been queen for a few years now. And evidently, the cousins, Mordecai and Esther, have done well to conceal the identity of Esther. The fact that she was a Jew has been concealed up to this point, up to the point before she became queen, and all through this time, it is still being kept secret as to who she is. But Haman, being apparently a superstitious man, or believing that the gods would give him the proper time as to when to carry out this dastardly deed, has this lot cast to find the exact time when it would be done. And notice that this, what we might call lucky day, is determined that it's 11 months into the future. He was doing this in the first month of the year, and it was determined that this would happen in the 12th month of the year. And this would give the Jews, perhaps unfortunately for Haman, time to prepare for the battle that's going to come. On the other hand, Haman may have thought, well, 11 months is okay. That will just torture these people even more as they anticipate with deadly anticipation for 11 months what's going to come to them. Watch the wily Haman go to work in verses 8 and 9. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." See him manipulate the king? Haman fools the king by convincing him that there is a potentially rebellious people within his empire. "Now, king, if you allow these people to continue to live here and to function, the implication is that you might have an overthrow, there might be a coup, who knows what kind of trouble is brewing if you don't exterminate this whole race of people." And notice that he says their laws are different than everyone else's. I mean, they're just contrary type of people. And Israel's laws were offensive to the world, even as the laws of Christ are offensive to the world. Numbers 23, verse 9, even said about Israel that it did not reckon itself among the nations. They saw themselves as being different, which was true, even as Christians see themselves set apart from the world. Not meaning that we're better than others, but we've come from the kingdom of Satan into the kingdom of Christ. And of course, we should never hold that position arrogantly. We should never look down the end of our noses at other people because they're not in the church. For we'll never convince someone to become a part of the church with that kind of an attitude. But because people do see us, or saw the Jews, as being separate, they're often offended by that and see that as a threat. Now, interestingly, did you notice that Haman did not mention who the people were? He didn't say, there's a group of people, the Jews, who are different and they're scattered and so on. I wonder why he left that off. My guess is that he did this because at least two former kings of Persia, Cyrus and Darius, had made laws giving freedom to the Jews, allowing them to leave Persia, if they so desired, going back to Judah, and even allowed them to be financed and to have guards and everything they needed to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. In other words, in the recent past, the Jews were favored by the Persians. Now here comes a man saying, now these people are really bad and you need to kill every single one of them. So he leaves off their name. Interestingly, he has this whole thing planned out. So the king does not have to be bothered or troubled by these people, and he doesn't even have to be troubled with the plan of genocide. See how Haman presents himself? You know, I'm one of the best servants. I am probably the best servant you've got. And we know later that that's the way he thought. We know later in the book of Esther that he was an arrogant man and really thought he was the best thing that ever happened to King Ahasuerus. He worked out a plan and even worked out the cost. He said, here's how much it's going to cost, and on top of that, king, I will pay it. I will pay the cost of this war. Well, that tells me Haman, first of all, had to have been very wealthy. Extremely wealthy. And that his hatred was extreme. He knew the Persian Empire itself was wealthy and they could carry out this evil work the government could all by itself. But he wanted to get on the best side of the king as much as he could. He was willing to finance this whole thing. He was willing to eliminate a whole race of people that he believed would hurt the ancient Iranian Empire. And it's mind-boggling that one man could pay so much. It's possible that he may have thought, well, I will pay this amount when we confiscate the goods of the Jews, and then we'll just give those to the soldiers and anyone else who was involved. Now, in my research, I found that the Persian kings received 14,500 talents of silver as their annual income. This man was proposing to pay over two-thirds of a king's annual income to finance this. Now, I tried to find out exactly how much money is involved there in American 2003 dollars. And the figures I got ranged anywhere from just over $47 million to what the margin says in my Bible of $3.84 billion. Well, even that smaller figure, $47 million plus, that's not small change for me. Maybe it is for some of you, but not for me. That's a lot of money. Especially when we get up into the billions. He was willing to give up so much to see a people destroyed. Isn't that phenomenal? How hatred can grow in the heart. But what I think is even more amazing than that is how much the king trusted Haman. Look how the story continues in verses 10 and 11. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you." Well, Haman proposed to pay for it. The king says, "Hey, you can have the money. I give it to you. Here's my signet ring giving you, excuse me, giving you full authority, all the authority of a king to carry this out. There was only one ring like his. And when a document was written and they sealed it with wax or clay, they would stamp it with that so that it was known that this was by the authority of the king. And remember, the Persian law, once it was set into motion, could not be changed. What he gave this man is absolutely incredible. And what is really sad is that Ahasuerus operated on rumor because he feared personal loss. And he evidently cared little for people. He didn't even say, well, who are these people? From where did they come? Why are they in trouble? He didn't ask anything. He so trusted Haman that, Haman, whatever you say, I agree with it. Perhaps this is why he had exalted Haman to such a high position in the first place. Now, brethren, perhaps we need to realize that sometimes we do the same thing. Maybe sometimes somebody will come to us and say something about another and we don't even investigate it. I urge every single one of us to listen to 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and to make sure that we operate on a principle that Paul laid down here, and actually Paul is quoting from the Old Testament. But what he says here, if King Ahasuerus had followed it, then this plan of genocide never would have been put into place. He never would have been manipulated by Haman. In fact, he would have seen what kind of man Haman was and would have disposed of him much earlier than what he actually ends up doing later. Listen to 2 Corinthians 13:1. Paul says, "This will be the third time I am coming to you by the mouth of two or three witnesses. Let every word be established." Well, a king should know. He should have had common sense to know that he should operate that way. He really didn't need to have what we just read from the Scripture. Common sense tells us we ought to operate that way. Now, back in our text, Esther 3:10, the writer noted that Haman was the enemy of the Jews. And I think the reason why that is so important is because centuries before this, as is recorded in Genesis chapter 12, God spoke to the great patriarch Abraham and told him in verse 3 that I will bless those who bless you and I will curse those who curse you. So the fact that Haman was the enemy of the Jews right there, he already had a curse on him. He's already defeated. And Abraham's people, who, according to the New Testament, are now Christians, we have that same thing with us, brethren. Whoever blesses us will be blessed. And whoever curses us and tries to hurt us, excuse me, and try to harm us, is already cursed by God until they repent. Well, let's go back to Esther 3. And now we see how the genocide is indeed going to be carried out. In verses 12 to 14, it says this. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. So the plan of Genesis, or of a genocide, is now being delivered to the entire empire, which was a large empire, reaching all the way from India in the east, all the way to Ethiopia in Africa on the west. And this genocide is growing out of one man's hatred for another people. But then again, I think actually many of the Persians felt this way. It's just that Haman expressed their hatred and had the plan and had the backing of the government and had the finances. But it will fail, as we'll see. Now, look at the atmosphere. Look how the chapter ends. After this plan goes out and everyone learns about it, verse 15 says this. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command. And the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Shushan was perplexed or confused. Well, the people of Persia are notified quickly because any delay could result in the plan failing. Now, what is said there at the end of verse 15, isn't that amazing? Don't let it escape your attention what is said in that last sentence. Look how the people of the capital city are responding. But look at King Ahasuerus and Haman. What is said there just can't be missed. The differences, the irony, is almost beyond belief. Those two men are hardened in their hearts in such a deep way. The king continues in his lavish manner of living and careless, totally careless of others. And notice the Bible is showing us here that the ability to remain indifferent to murder is not or was not a problem of mental instability, But it was self-centeredness on the part of King Ahasuerus and pride on the part of Haman. But that's what sin does to us. It can happen to any of us. Sin can harden a person's heart, making him lose all sensitivity, preventing his heart from being pricked by guilt. Some people have a conscience that's been seared with a hot iron, according to 1 Timothy 4 and verse 2. You've been burned before, and if you've been burned bad enough, you know the scar that it leaves and how it the feeling is gone. Paul says that some people can get a conscience like that. It's like it's been seared with a hot iron. It can't be touched anymore. It can't feel anymore. It can commit sin, any sin, in this case murder, and not think anything about it. It decides to sit down and say, hey, let's have a drink. Ephesians chapter 4 also paints a graphic picture of these men, but of anyone who is attempting to live a life alienated from God. Now, yesterday and Friday, my wife and I were in Klamath Falls, and we attended a humanism seminar that the Nile Street Church over there is hosting with Brother Robert Wagoner. And it was excellent, I believe, in the information he was giving and showing what happens when people try to approach life without God. And this is what Ephesians 4 is going to show us. I know the word humanism does not appear here, but it's certainly in this passage. That is, take God out of life and let humans work on their own. But watch what happens. Starting at verse 17 of Ephesians 4. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles, like King Ahasuerus or Haman, walk, in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart, who, being past feeling, because they're alienated from God and they refuse to have God in their knowledge, Paul says they are past feeling. And have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanness with greediness. Shushan was perplexed back in Esther 3. Perhaps all the Persians were wondering, well, who would be next? If a race of people among us could be so easily dispensed, what about me? I'm a Persian, it's true, but maybe I don't fit the bill of what they want in their empire. Maybe I'll be next. Who knows? And undoubtedly, a lot of the Persians had made friends with the Jews. I want to show you five passages here real quick from the book of Proverbs, because I think it's showing exactly what's happening in the book of Proverbs, or in the book of Esther. And you've probably seen this at different times in our own nation's history, as well as in the history of other nations. Proverbs 28 has three of the passages. Proverbs 28 and verse 12 says this: when the righteous rejoice, there is great glory. But when the wicked arise, men hide themselves. Verse 15 of Proverbs 28. Like a roaring lion and a charging bear is a wicked ruler over poor people. Verse 28. When the wicked arise, men hide themselves. But when they perish, the righteous increase. Proverbs 29, verse 2. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. And then earlier in Proverbs, Proverbs 11, verse 11. By the blessing of the upright, the city is exalted, but it is overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. Brothers and sisters, let us be careful in what we hear from and about other people. But never forget this. If you are devoted to the Lord, there will be people who will resent that devotion. And they will do everything they can to fight against you and destroy you. Mordecai remained true to his principles, although it could cost him his life. And if delivered, which he believed, we'll find out tonight, he believed would happen. But if delivered, he didn't know how the deliverance would come or from whom it would come, but he knew it would. But I want to ask you, do we always have to know the outcome to remain true to what is right? What if the outcome is, if I remain true to what is right, I lose my life, or I lose my job, or I don't get the promotion, or I lose a friend? Should we wet our finger and put it up in the air and find out where the wind's blowing before we first determine if I'm going to be true to what is right? Mordecai didn't. He was true to what was right regardless. There's one more passage I want to show you this morning. It's found in Philippians 1. If you are a Christian, I believe you're like Mordecai. You cannot lose. Philippians 1 has a reading in it that shows a man who could not lose. Because how do you defeat a man? If he dies, he considers it a victory. And if he stays alive, he considers it a victory as well. But is that not what it's like for the faithful disciple of Christ? If we die, we finally get to go home. We get to go to heaven. That's what we're all striving for anyways, isn't it? But if we continue to live, well, we stay here and keep doing what we're doing already. And we're happy that way too. Concerning Paul's time in jail, he knew that he would be delivered. And he was. He's not in jail, in a Roman jail cell at this time, is he? He knew he wouldn't be there forever. He didn't know if he would be released in the normal way or if it would be by death. So here's what he wrote in Philippians 1, starting verse 19. For I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but with all boldness as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor, yet what I shall choose I cannot tell. For I am hard-pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. He couldn't lose. But he could write those words because he had already died to himself. That's why many years previous to this, he had been baptized. He was already dead. He finally acknowledged that. And so he was buried in some water. And then the man who baptized him, Ananias, brought him up out of the water, and he was then a new creature. And some of you may be at that point now. You finally sing the last verse of the song we sang just before I got up. You are finally saying, none of self and all of thee. So are you ready to bury the old self and to have a new self resurrected? If so, please come forward now as we stand and sing.